This episode of Hodinkee Radio is brought to you by Accutron and the new DNA Casino Collection. With 100 pieces made in four vibrant colors, the Accutron DNA Casino perfectly fuses futuristic watchmaking and bold design. Stay tuned later in the show for more on the brand's new collection, or visit AccutronWatch.com for all the details. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Hodinkee Radio. The watch world is kicking into high gear, guys. Watches and Wonders is only about a month away. We've got exciting releases to talk about for just a few minutes here at the top. Maybe the biggest release of the year so far we're going to get to from Omega in just a second. Yep. But before that, let me introduce the guests. First of all, you already heard him, founder Ben Clymer. Ben, how are you doing today?
Do you think that they could tell it was me when I said yep?
Of course, yes, Ben, yep. Come on. It's like one of those songs that you can recognize with one note. You know, you play a note of Thriller or something like that.
People, I was going to say, hey, Jude, but yeah, Thriller works. I appreciate that. How are you, Tony?
I'm good. Thank you so much for being on the show. You know, a few weeks ago, you were on calling from your home office here, and I'm glad that we get to see some of what we've got going on in the background here. All kinds of goodies. All sorts of stuff.
Yeah, so someday we'll do a tour of all the stuff. It's still being set up, thus the boxes and such kind of right there, but we're getting there.
Okay, along with Ben, we've got our client advisor, former Division I athlete, Rich Forden, who is sitting just a few offices away from me in the Hodinkee Radio headquarters down in New York City. Rich, how you doing today?
Good. Thanks for having me on your show, Tony. Appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. The first thing that we're going to talk about is something I alluded to. The biggest release of the year, I would say. I mean, anytime a new Speedmaster is released, it's exciting news, I would say. But yep. Just this week, it'll be about a week and a half since it's been released by the time this is published. But we got a white dial Speedmaster, long sort of teased. Daniel Craig wore it to the Omega event thing last year in New York. So we knew it was coming. I think the surprise is that it's a Speedmaster. It's exactly what we expected. A Speedmaster is a Speedmaster, but the dial is a white lacquer. Ben, any thoughts on what we saw from Omega?
Yeah, I mean, look, we all kind of knew that it was coming, as you said rightly, because he wore that watch to an event in the fall. It was interesting because I own the Canopus white gold 3861. Which is also a white dial Speedmaster. And it's like, this watch looks just like it from afar. And it's so like to the point where like there were photographs of me, we did an event, I think the night after or two nights after Daniel Craig's event at the Omega pop-up. And people are like, oh, is Ben wearing the same watch that Daniel Craig was? And I often get confused for Daniel Craig, so I'm kind of used to that. But like, this was really like, hey, like these watches are so similar. The Canopus watch is like, it's one of my favorite, most understated watches. And so now all of a sudden you've got basically the same look, but with a lacquer dial, which an argument could be made is more interesting than even the dial that's on the Canopus watch. And it's going to be super hot. I mean, we've seen it already. The sentiment in our comments on our site and certainly on Instagram have been, we'll say, like overwhelmingly positive in a way that, you know, most new releases, even from Omega, don't really get. So it's a big deal. There's no question about it. And anytime you get a new variation on the Moonwatch, which this is not like some automatic thing or some, you know, coaxial so-and-so. Like this is the true Moonwatch with a white dial. So very compelling. The lacquer was a surprise. Look, I think it's obviously going to be a huge hit for them.
Rich, anything we can add there?
Yeah, just to keep our friends at Omega happy, that'd be Planet Omega, the event.
Planet Daniel Omega.
Craig was at.
Right, yes, Planet Omega. Yes. Daniel Craig and Ben Clymer. And I think you came to an event too, Rich. Weren't you there?
Yeah, I was there the same night as you, but didn't get photographed.
You didn't get the photo, right. It was me, Andrew Garfield, the lady from the show with that guy.
Ted Lasso.
And Rich Orton. That was basically all who attended that night.
Yeah, I was stage right. But
right. That's right.
No, I think it's good that you brought up the Canopus Gold, because my thoughts on this watch are it's been a few years since we had a mainline Speedy variant introduced that isn't a premium option. You know, we had the Moonshot Gold with the green dial and these various gold or precious metal options, but something that's in the core collection at what I think is reasonable and what the community seem to think is reasonable upcharge from the core Speedmaster Moonwatch, something that's steel and hopefully available with the new dial, and even more so than the new dial color, like a new material. I think this all matters, and it's injecting new life, hopefully, into the Speedmaster, because as an owner and lover of that watch, it did feel a little stale as of late.
Well, Rich calling the Speedmaster stale is is right up there with Ben calling the Crash pedestrian, I would say.
Oh, don't do that to me.
As far as hot takes are concerned.
Rich wants no comparisons to me anywhere.
Yeah. Well, listen, that's great. Thanks for indulging the Speedmaster discussion, guys. I know we've covered it on the site, and I'm sure we'll have more coverage at some point soon whenever we can get hands-on with the watch. But I just wanted to talk about it for just a minute from two Speedmaster lovers in the office. Okay, so that's Omega, and they're not even the only big brand that's released big watches over the past week and a half. Yeah. By the time that this publishes, we'll have seen the batch of releases from Audemars Piguet for the first half of the year. Basically, they release a batch of watches in the first half of the year and the second half of the year. We've seen the first half of the year now. There's a lot of Royal Oak. There's a lot of Code 1159. Ben, I know you've taken some time to think about the most exciting watches for you as an enthusiast, a collector of AP. So maybe I'll just turn it over to you there. And if you can give me some of your punch list of highlights real quick.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the big takeaway for me, and this is not a surprise to anybody, is John's watch, right? Like, there's a John Mayer perpetual calendar Audemars Piguet Royal Oak, which is kind of amazing, considering that he has been very conscious about not kind of alienating the core community by doing something like this for so long, which is why, frankly, we did the G-Shock, right? Like, we did three G-Shocks with his name on it, and then he kind of spearheaded the projects that I did and Elijah and Ed. And he said, you know what, like, he, over the past few years, and we'll let him speak for himself at some point, but like, over the past few years, he's just developed an incredibly close, real relationship with Francois and now Ilaria at AP. And so he basically made a watch, and the watch is incredibly subtle. I would call it kind of like the anti-Cactus Jack, the anti-Travis Scott. Like, the Travis Scott watch was so wild, right? Like, a new color ceramic and like his logo on it. Travis really took, I don't want to say liberties, but like, he really made like dramatic adjustments to what the Royal Oak perpetual calendar is. And the perpetual after the jumbo is kind of like, you know, holy ground within AP. John kind of went the other way, and like, him being kind of the scholar of AP that he is and scholar of watchmaking that he is, he referenced the Tuscan dial, like the beautiful kind of blue Tuscan dial that we've seen on the platinum jumbo, and we've seen them on perpetuals here and there. He referenced that, but with a new production method.
It's called the Crystal Sky.
Crystal Sky. But I think, you know, John being John and being the design nut that he is, like, there's a lot more to the tweaks to this watch than just like a new dial. There's a lot of typeface changes. There are date changes. So if you look at like 31 and 1 on the perpetual calendar, which has long been something that we've kind of said, like, just needs to be adjusted, just as like somebody that appreciates like thoughtful design. It's a really neat watch, and it's white gold, which is, you know, a favorite metal of mine. I mean, my favorite Royal Oak of all time happens to be white gold. And it's limited to 200 pieces. I think it's just the standout, you know. And I think, you know, John is obviously an important figure in the watch collecting world. So him doing a perpetual with AP of all brands, I think, you know, means a lot. You know, the other new releases were more kind of like incremental changes, like some said, like, okay, like, it's additive for sure, but it's not revelatory. And so you get a new 37 millimeter RD3, which is, again, a favorite watch of mine, now with diamond baguette on the dial, which is a neat thing. You get some new dials and configurations on the 41 millimeter flying tourbillon, which is a non-RD3 tourbillon. You get new open work in this new kind of proprietary gold. They killed the stainless steel open work jumbo, which is cool. So that's kind of done now. It lasts 50th anniversary plus 1 year. It's the fifth anniversary of Code. So they kind of revamp Code in their own way. If you like AP, you're going to love all this stuff. It's just new variations on stuff that have been incredibly difficult to get and incredibly sought after for the past few years. But I think the big narrative here from, I think, the collector standpoint is the John Mayer perpetual.
Sand gold was that proprietary gold that you were reaching
sand gold,
for there,
yeah, Ben. Which looks great. Cool. I mean, it's looks like cool a gray things. Gold. I mean, like, yeah. Gold and gray. Like, what, you know, what more does a man need? So it's very neat. And of course, like, these watches will be challenging to get. But I think, you know, and we'll talk about this later in the episode. But I think, like, even AP, like, the world is returning to normal, and I think that is really true. Even with AP,
I think this is something we've started to hear as we start to hear about what's going to be coming from Watches and Wonders, but I think it's going to be an incremental year for a lot of brands, not releasing crazy watches as things have slowed down, as sales channels have filled up, and it'll be more incremental and building on what's working and variations and all of that type of stuff instead of going completely bananas.
Yep, that makes sense.
Well, that kind of naturally transitions us into the next thing I wanted to talk about for a few minutes, guys, is the Morgan Stanley Lux Consult report on the Swiss watch industry. It comes out every year. You all probably see the charts of the top 10 or the top 50 watch brands Swiss watch brands, I should say. These are all estimates that are produced yearly from the two authors of the report. And as always, the first headline from the report is always Rolex. It's the largest Swiss watch brand. As you all know, its market share continues to be about 30%, 31% of the entire industry. And this year, the report said that for the first time, Rolex crossed an estimated $10 billion in Swiss francs in sales. It says it's the first Swiss watch brand to ever do that. As I said, they maintained about a 30% market share, which if you look at it, is about as much as the next five brands combined. Another fun fact I saw in there is that they have more market share than any other luxury brand. So no other luxury brand dominates its category like Rolex. Louis Vuitton perhaps is the closest. They've got about 20% of the bag market. And listen, guys, this is always the headline, Ben. Anything you want to say here about the consolidation of Rolex in the marketplace? It's something we all knew was kind of coming and we all experience every day. Anything to add?
One question is, how do they know, right? Like, what is the methodology behind this report? And I know these guys, and I know it's Morgan Stanley and Olivier, who I've known forever. But I Rolex is intensely secretive, and I wouldn't put too much stock in those numbers. I really wouldn't. And I'm not. This is not me, calling into question the entire report. I believe all the other numbers. The only one that I'm not sure on is Rolex, just because they take pride in their secrecy. I mean, it's CIA like. So it could be even bigger than that, to be clear, or it could be a little bit smaller than that. So I just don't know how real those numbers are, but assuming they are real, it's wild. But yeah, I mean, just, you know, look, Rolex is king. They always have been, they always will be. And that's where the story ends, I think.
Yeah, it is sort of emblematic of consolidation of the top brands, I would say. The other thing that the report kind of emphasizes is just the kind of continued polarization in the market. So it says that it calls them kind of the big four of the independents. So in addition to Rolex, Patek, AP, and Richard Mille, they hold about 44% market share in total of the entire Swiss watch industry, which is up 7 or 8% since before the pandemic. So the big continue to get bigger, I suppose, is kind of the general theme that has been coming out of this report over the last few years. And I think that's something that sounds true to us, right?
Yeah, I'd agree. I thought with Rolex, it was interesting. They quoted a $15 billion estimated sales in total, like including or what they could have gotten to if they're selling all their watches direct to consumer. That number to me stood out because, like Ben is saying, I know that there's noise in this. If they're going to that level to estimate, you know, potential sales, if they were to retail ready or retail to consumer all of their watches, it tells me that there's more noise in this than even I would assume with the $10 billion number. But reports like this are always interesting and you can draw conclusions from them. But like we're saying, the numbers themselves, maybe not putting too much stock, especially when it comes to Rolex.
Yeah, I think that's right. Directionally interesting, but any particular number or figure, kind of a grain of salt for all of the things that you're talking about. But man, if it's not fun to like look at these things, almost like, you know, NBA standings or something like that, who's up, who's totally down and all of that type of stuff.
It's fascinating.
Well, and it kind of brings me to a few more brands I wanted to talk about quickly. So it pointed out Vacheron as the ninth brand to join what we call the billion franc club, I suppose. So it says surpassing $1 billion in sales for the first time, joining brands like Rolex and Longines, et cetera. The other big sort of winners, just long-term success stories that I saw are Hermès, and its kind of continued push into watches has been really successful. And if you look at a sort of a five-year span, you can see them moving up the charts every year. I think they sit at something like 16th or so now in terms of size and Swiss brands. And then the other one is Swatch, which moved from 22nd to 13th, it said, on the
We're
back of
the Swatch, the brand, not the
Swatch, the brand. Yeah. On the back of Moonswatch, it sure said estimating 2 million were sold last year, which is double what Swatch reported in the first year of the Moonswatch sales, which obviously makes sense and accounted for about 66% of its sales, perhaps. So, they catch a lot of flack for it in our comments at this point, but, you know, it's nothing but a huge standout commercial success for Swatch.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'll speak to both those. Like Hermès, we sell them, we love them. I mean, I've written stories over the years, I mean, many years ago, so like citing how kind of real they were and how seriously they took watchmaking. So it's not a huge surprise. They also have like the best brand cachet of any brand in the world, and that includes Rolex and Louis Vuitton. Like Hermès is just like peerless when it comes to prestige in terms of what that brand means. And then Swatch, like, yeah, again, like, you know, nerdy commenters on Hodinkee or Instagram can say what they want all day, but like the Moon Swatch and even the Blanc Pont, these are unabashed successes. Like there's just no question about that. I always, like, whenever I do these pods, I always think about the texts I get from my real friends, as in the people that are not in the watch world. And when Moon Swatch came out, I probably had 10 or 15 guys and gals that I knew from high school, college, up here, upstate where I live, asking me about it. How can they get one? Some of them waited in line. I mean, it was just a fun thing. It was a real, like, cultural moment. And as I've said before, we haven't had a moment like that since Apple Watch, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, that's about right.
First watch beyond the two products, the Moon Swatch and the Blanc Pont. I mean, I even found myself walking into Swatch boutiques more since those products have come out. And if you take a browse through a Swatch boutique, if there's one near you, which we don't need to get into that conversation again, like we always do, but there are plenty of really interestingly designed watches on the shelves every day. And it's kind of easy to walk in there and spend $200, you know, like it's very low barrier to entry. It's very cool. The designs are interesting. And with more foot traffic stopping by to see if they have a Moon Swatch, I can imagine that there's only positive externalities with the rest of their collection as well, which is, you know, a success. No matter what you think about those two products on their own, clearly from a business perspective, it was a success.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that brings up a whole nother conversation that we should talk about at some point on this show. It's just like, why do brands do limited editions? You know, like I'm wearing my AP, but I've got my G-Shock right here. Like, why would Casio do a watch with me? Why would they do a watch with, well, why with me? That's a really good question. But like, why would they do it with John Mayer or Ed Sheeran? Or why, you know, I was lecturing yesterday at Cornell, and I wore our limited edition Vacheron on purpose because like that represented a big moment for us commercially and culturally. And like, why would Vacheron do that watch? It's because like these moments, which only represent, you know, in that case, a few million bucks in revenue, which is a lot, but not that much, now that they're doing a billion plus, why would they do it? Because it jumpstarts things. Like it gets people talking about stuff. And you might not be able to get the Hodinkee Vacheron Cornes de Vache, but 3 or 4 years later, they came out with their own steel Cornes de Vache. And like, there's a whole like kind of business case to examine why brands do this stuff. And, you know, people are so quick to shit on limited editions, but like they work. That has been validated time and time again. And it gives the consumer something that is different, because some people just want the whatever, the black dial Omega 3861. And some people want the white dial. And then some people want the Hodinkee edition. And some people want the Snoopy. And it's like, it just allows consumers to differentiate themselves in a way that it also drives the business. And so, yeah, that's a whole other conversation. But
well, can we double click on it for just a minute, since you led the horse to water there, Ben? I mean, Hodinkee has done as many limited editions as we have over the years. For one reason or another. And I'm curious what sort of the most common reason is from the brand perspective that they want to partner with someone like Hodinkee.
You want to know why? What are the two brands that you just mentioned that have climbed the most this year?
What did I say? I said Hermes and Swatch Group, right?
Right. And guess who collaborated with both those brands upwards of 5 years ago? You know, it's like
causation.
Yeah, exactly. Like I seldom say things like that, but like, you know, it's the moon swatch in particular, like that is a product of collaborations that came before it. And, you know, I'm not saying just ours, to be clear, but like, you know, we did G-Shock, you know, we always try to do something that's like Hodinkee centric, but also very approachable every year around the holidays. We started doing swatches many, many years ago. We did a father son set or mother daughter set. Swatch is cool. They were System 51, so different than this. And Hermes, we've done two collaborations with. I wore my blue dial slim recently. Like these are great watches, and there's no question that. And again, I'm truly not saying us, but sites like ours and collaborations they've done with people like us really do make a difference, because it puts them on the radar of people who care. And if you look at both of our Hermes collaborations, our Swatch collaborations, like those Swatch collaborations are on the wrists of some of the biggest collectors in the world. And they're only buying them because they discovered it through us. Same with the Hermeses, the two Hermes products. There's a lot that goes into something like this. And obviously like Hermes and Swatch did a lot of great things along with collaborations with us and others. But there's no question that like, you know, these type of products can really yield great success down the road. It doesn't happen overnight, obviously, but yeah, look, I think limited editions can really work, and it goes far beyond that, you know, whatever day-long hype fest and then sell out. It can last for years.
Right, I agree with that. I think circling back to Swatch, what I was giving them props for is a limited edition business case to sell other products doesn't always work if you don't have the compelling products in the rest of the catalog. And I think Swatch has that, whereas some brands don't. They can have a limited edition moment, get more eyeballs, and they're not selling a ton of the rest of their collection because maybe there's not compelling product there. But I think Swatch does have compelling product all over the place.
Agreed.
Well, to Ben's point, you have to be ready to capitalize if that increased attention does come your way. It's funny, Vacheron, they pointed to sort of 2016, 2017 as kind of an inflection point. And I think that's around, is that around when the limited edition was? I can't even remember.
I'm done kind of giving myself credit for stuff. So
I say this as it was but one piece of the puzzle, because that's the same year that the Overseas was redone. They released the new Overseas, the 4500, and they slimmed it down and made it a sleeker design and all of these types of things. They modernized it. They pointed to that time as like when the catalog was really started to become refined. So the Hodinkee limited edition was but one small piece of that puzzle.
Such a small piece, indeed.
Yeah,
indeed.
Yeah.
That was the time period.
Well, and let's go to the other side of the coin real quick, because we'll talk about a brand that Hodinkee has also done limited editions with that is saw declining sales and declined in the charts a little bit. But
Impossible, Tony.
No, one of the things that these reports always remind me of is how small the enthusiast community is and how insubstantial it can be at the end of the day to the larger commercial aspirations of these companies. So two of the brands that saw declines were Tag Heuer, said declined like 7%, Tudor around the same 4%, which is interesting because if you had read the pages of Hodinkee for the past year, you would have said, oh, Tag Heuer had a great year. They released the new glass boxes. You may have seen my review of The Week on the Wrist with the Carrera and said that's a pretty good watch. Tudor continues to sort of fire on all cylinders with the 54, but the enthusiast sort of corner of the world is but a small piece of the pie, I think.
I thought that there was another interesting point about enthusiast corner being small, which is the fourth sentence of the report referencing success versus headwinds from smartwatches and people not wanting to wear watches. When have we had that conversation on Hodinkee? In, I think it's been probably 4 or 5 years since.
It's not a conversation.
Right. Yeah. In our world, it's not. Apparently, in the larger mass market, it is. I was reminded how small my opinions matter to the larger market by the fourth sentence of the report. So
they mean a lot to me, Rich. I want you to know that.
Thank you, Ben.
Yeah. To be fair, I was kind of reminded. As I said, I was at Cornell yesterday speaking to a grad class, and I would always say, like, you know, who here like has an interest in watches at all? And in the grad class, there was like, you know, I'd say 20% was like kind of into it. And then I asked the same question in the undergrad class. And like, I got like three kind of like sheepish, like, you know, like I'm embarrassed to raise my hand type of things. And it's just a different world, you know, and it's a small world. But I think on the tag thing in particular, we sell tag, as you guys know, we have done well with that new glass box in a meaningful way, the Carrera glass box. We are a smaller retailer, you know, relative to some of their bigger boxes for sure. But it also comes down to deliveries. Right. Like you can introduce the hottest thing in the world, but if you can't deliver them, then you're not making those sales. And then I think, you know, many brands had record years in 22 and 21 and have been trying to anniversary that. And that's really hard. Like Rolex can still sell whatever they deliver. And that's going to stay that way. AP, even though it might take a few more calls now than it did before, can still sell everything they deliver. Lange, I believe, still can as well. Again, might take a few more calls, but they can do it. But those other brands that appeal to people like us a little bit more in the Tag, Tudor, Omega world, they're like, oh man, you know, I can't swing an unexpected $7,000 purchase right now for a Carrera. And I think that is a really real thing, as we've seen. Even though the economy is frankly much better now than it was 18 months ago, like the world is just slightly less confident, I think, in making these purchases, because we've seen the thing that we all knew at Hodinkee, which is like what goes up must come down at least a little. And the secondary prices of these watches have softened a little bit. And so I think people are just slightly less confident in non kind of tier one purchases.
We're excited that Hodinkee Radio is back. And our return is thanks in part to this week's sponsor, Accutron, and its new DNA Casino Collection. Driven by the world's first electrostatic energy movement, the new Accutron DNA Casino Collection fuses vibrant colors with futuristic design. The four bold new colors, each limited to 100 pieces, are inspired by the bright lights of Las Vegas. The DNA is an update of Accutron's original icon, the Space View, the watch known for its revolutionary tuning fork movement. The DNA updates the Accutron Space View for the modern era with a 45mm stainless steel case and integrated rubber strap. Since introducing the world's first fully electronic watch in 1960, Accutron has continued to push the boundaries of timekeeping. The Accutron DNA Casino Collection synthesizes bold colors, innovative technology, and a retro-futuristic design to make a bold statement. Accutron. It's not a timepiece, it's a conversation piece. Check out the new DNA Casino Collection on AccutronWatch.com or the new Citizen Flagship Store in New York. A big thanks to Accutron for its support, and now, back to the show. Well, maybe we can leave the business corner discussion with our own Professor Clymer, I suppose, now that you're giving lectures at an Ivy League university. We can leave the discussion there for now. There's one sort of fun, maybe 5-minute discussion I wanted to have with you guys. It's less numbers driven, and hopefully you'll indulge me here and it'll be a little bit fun. But the Oscars will have taken place between us recording and publishing this. So I thought it'd be fun. This is something I actually think about with some frequency, is a story in the watch world that would make for a good Hollywood film. Hopefully something you guys have given a little bit of thought to based on my prompts, but maybe we can give sort of a recommendations as to Hollywood, a story that we think might make for an actually good Oscar worthy, hopefully even film if you get the right casting and director. Any of you want to go first?
I've got an idea, but Rich, you want to lead the way?
Sure. I do have an idea, which I ran by Tony, which seemed acceptable for the podcast. So we'll see. I think the story of Jacob the Jeweler is interesting for a movie, although I'm not an expert on the product, nor am I an expert on the cultural relevancy of the story of Jacob. I think there's a lot to dig in there, and a screenwriter and director could, you know, go any which direction, from 47th Street to an established brand and a court case along the way involving conspiracy and so on. So I think there's a lot to dig into there. But I'm not the guy to dig into it. Maybe I need to do a little bit of reading, which I will admit. But
yeah, I mean, you read Malaika's story on Jacob, obviously.
I did.
Yeah, that I mean, that's a good place to start. And she, you know, graciously left out some of the more nefarious kind of nuggets, I guess. But yeah, the Jacob story is amazing. If you've ever met him, he is like, I mean, you won't be surprised to hear this, but like, he's the most charming guy you could possibly imagine, right? Like, he's incredible. He's absolutely incredible. So yeah, that's a good one, Rich. Well done.
I think a part of a good movie too is like a main character who is extremely well dressed in his time. I love the photos of Jacob coming out of the 90s of like him in a big double-breasted suit. Like, every time it makes me smile. And the cameos would be great, obviously, you know, celebrities rolling through. So you know, Tony, go ahead. What do you got? You actually think about this. So
the one that I had that was kind of similar to this in eras is kind of the rise and fall of Frank Mueller, kind of the original indie watchmaker, rock star, very close to all kinds of celebrities you could get. We've talked about Elton John, but all kinds of celebrity potential cameos as well. And then you kind of have the same kind of fallout that happened in the early 2000s, flew a little bit too close to the sun, all kinds of alleged criminal activity. You get accusations of drugs and a falling out with a business partner. And he, you know, eventually leaves the company that has his name on the door when he's really at the height of his powers. And I think it would be an amazing story as well. Ben, what do you have for us?
It's a little bit different. I think this would be more like a doc. And that would be the story of the Lenin 2499. You know, that story has a lot to it. You know, and we haven't really heard kind of the last of it, and it's still kind of ongoing. And I think that one could be really compelling. I think there are other stories about fake watches or watches that have been faked that could be really neat. You know, I think like if you take and follow the life of like a Senza Luna, or, you know, some obscure Patek, like high-end Patek Philippe or Rolex, there's the potential for some really interesting storytelling there, because there's just so many dynamic characters there. But the Lenin one, because of obviously the celebrity nature of it and like the modernity of it, like the fact that it's like still ongoing present day, I think could do really well.
I think that's the one that could actually happen as well. I think it will likely appear at auction one day. Who knows if that's in a year or 25 years, but I think it might, and I think it will do extremely well, and people always love Beatles related content. So I think there's like a strong possibility that this one could actually happen at some point. And it's got twists and turns over dozens of years, really. And there's all kinds of interesting things. You know, I wrote kind of the story 6 months ago when Arthur Touchot, a former Hodinkee employee, kind of posted about the court case. And I wrote the story for us that dug into a little bit more detail about what had happened with the watch over the past 40 years. And, you know, I've gotten texts and emails and stuff about it since then. That
from Yoko?
Yeah. from people like Yoko Ono, of course, and others, that the whole story is still not out there. So perhaps one day it'll be Hollywoodified. The next thing I think we're going to talk about for the bulk and the remainder of our conversation is kind of the opposite of something that we've talked about recently on podcast episodes. You know, Ben, last time you and Malaika and I chatted, we talked about watches that are hot in the market, honestly, these small watches, jewelry watches, Cartier, et cetera, things that people are really excited about in the market, things that sell quickly. Today, we're going to talk about the opposite. We're going to talk about brands, watchmakers that seem to be underappreciated by the market. Especially brands that may or may not perform well on the secondary market. We're going to talk about why that might be the case, if there's room for them to grow. And I think we're going to start here, guys. What do you think is the brand that, you know, to bring people behind the scenes a little bit, we have a group chat with us and a few other employees here at Hodinkee that we talk about watch brands every once in a while. And you know the brand that comes up probably the most often on this group chat, guys?
What's that?
It's Laurent Ferrier. Something you wouldn't think about, right? They make a few hundred watches a year. And you can go back to 2010 Hodinkee days when Hodinkee was just starting out and Laurent Ferrier was just starting out as well. And you can find quotes of Ben Clymer himself calling Laurent Ferrier, you know, making perhaps the finest automatic movements in the world when they first came out with those, the micro rotor. And then kind
I think they still are, for the record. Like, I can't think of a better automatic watch or like a more interesting finely finished automatic watch than them. But go
on. Let's just start there, Ben, because the brand has been around for 15 years now or something like that. Laurent Ferrier is a legendary watchmaker. The story of him is also like legendary. For those who don't know, I guess I'll just say it briefly, but he kind of used to be just a semi-professional race car driver. He was second or third place at Le Mans, Paul Newman was also on the podium with him in 1979. You know, for people who don't know, he's kind of this legendary cool guy, and he always will be. And after that, he spent 4 decades basically at Patek as a watchmaker there before stepping out and starting a brand with his own name on it. And I know, Ben, it's a brand that you have always loved. I want to talk about, you know, first of all, let's just start there. I mean, you called it and still said it is one of the best, if not the best, automatic movement in the world. Like, just let's unpack that statement itself for a minute.
Yeah, I think I feel like every time I talk to you, Tony, I feel like older and older, because I'm always like, you don't remember, like 10 years ago, it was like the hottest shit in the world. But like, really, you know, somebody asked me, it may have been you, somebody asked me when the last time I was like really excited about a new watch. And I think back to those early days of like 2010, 11, 12, like kind of like when I was really, really starting to hit my stride in terms of like understanding watches and having the cultural relevancy to like have access to stuff and whatever. And seeing the Laurent Ferrier Tourbillon and like a hidden Tourbillon, it was described as a Laurent Ferrier Tourbillon, which it was. It was designed by them, but B&B, which is now Lefebvre Tuton, which is now Louis Vuitton, was making it for them. And that's okay. Like, his son worked there. It was just spectacular. I mean, just like a revelation of what I thought a Swiss watch should be, which was elegant. It was, you know, look almost like a 25-26. A lot of them had enamel dials, but on you flip it over, you have this insanely finely finished hand-wound tourbillon. And of course, the price was like 180 Swiss and like, you know, just crazy stuff. So it never really, like, I was in love with it, but I could never conceive of owning one. And then 2 years later, they came out with this micro rotor that was the same watch, but without a tourbillon, but instead a self-winding movement. And this had a natural escapement, which, like, you know, I'm not sure how familiar our audience is at scale with what like that means, but like, this is not a normal watch. A natural escapement is like not an easy thing to do. And when Nick Manousos used to write for us, who's now at the HSNY and he is an actual watchmaker and a very technical guy, I said, between Dufour, Roger Smith and Laurent Ferrier, who do you think is the greatest watchmaker of those three? He goes, it's not even close. It's Laurent Ferrier, because they invented an escapement, or they recreated an escapement. And, you know, you can say, you know, Roger has worked on the coaxial. That was a George Daniels thing. Dufour has done some incredible things, the Grand Sonnerie wristwatch and the duality, of course. but to be figure out a way to engineer and produce a natural escapement that looks like that and at scale is was really remarkable. And they were just so cool. And I remember writing those early stories saying, like, this is what Patek should be making. And I still think this is they are kind of what Patek should be making, because if you, I mean, the Calatrava caliber has gotten a lot better over the past 2 years, but in 2010 to 2013, 2014, you're talking like tiny little movements that were basically from the, like the mid 70s in their Calatravas selling for $25,000. The LF was double that. The LF was say $40,000, but it was so much better and so much more finely finished and so just wonderful on the wrist. And like everything that I thought a high-end Swiss watch should be in one brand, plus the motorsport thing, plus the connection to Patek, et cetera. And it was just wonderful. And like, I remember William Messina bought the first prototype Galet self-winding watch at Only Watch. And he got it was a steel watch. And I bought mine. And all of a sudden, like all the right, you know, the air quotes right guys were buying them. And I was like, how could this fail? You know, how could it fail? And then it to be clear, it hasn't failed, but it has not succeeded in the way that I thought it would. I'll say that.
Maybe we can talk about what you mean by that. What's happened over the past few years, and maybe this is where Rich, our esteemed client advisor, can help out a little bit, but just talk about what the market for Laurent Ferrier is like nowadays and where there is or isn't demand for his watches or their watches.
Yeah, I think I can continue what Ben was talking about there and say, at least let's take a step back first. Tony and I have the same sort of frame of reference for Laurent Ferrier, I think. In that time of 2010 to 2012, I was a consumer of watch media, certainly not a consumer of watches at this level or involved in watches professionally or even on the side or whatever you want to say. But I remember.
Is that because you were in high school or is that?
I think that would have been high school. Yes.
Okay. Just making sure.
You're on the baseball diamond, as we discussed. Yeah.
On my way to be a Division I athlete, as I was.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I remember seeing those photos on Hodinkee and elsewhere and just thinking, my perception at that time was that everybody cared about this. And I can tell you now in 2024, few people care about it. So I want to throw a question back to Ben before I go further and ask, at that time, was it just you, Nick Manousos, and William Messina that cared? Or was there really a mass market appeal to this thing?
No, never mass market. But I mean, like they were making 80 watches a year. So the intent was never to be mass market. But I can tell you that like I've got a group of friends that are not known publicly in the New York area that are all serious collectors that have owned Dufours and that, you know, were responsible for the original Observatoire series from Kyrie and like really like hardcore watch nerds. And every one of them had Laurent Ferriers, like whether it was a Tourbillon, whether it was the GMT, whether it was the automatic. I mean, they all had them and they were all like, wow, this is like a great everyday watch. If you're talking about the self-winding one. And we all believe that it could really be the next thing. I posted my original unique watch, or was unique watch, on Instagram the other day. And I got a lot of people saying like, hey, I just bought one. I love this thing. So like people do want them and they are buying them at retail, but like the secondary market is not in its favor right now. I can tell you that. And I think like that's probably like why Tony brought this up, because like if you look at Roger Smith at Dufour, at Rechep, at Carey, whoever, all these high-end, Jorn, of course, all these guys that were like contemporaries of Laurent Ferrier as a brand, those guys experienced just enormous growth over the past 5 years, 4 years. And LF kind of feels like it was left out on the side.
I can ask the question directly then, because you brought it up a little bit there, but you mentioned the watch that you had was unique at one time and now it's not. You can pull the punch if you want, but is there a story of mismanagement there that is tied to not only your watch, but like, was there a little bit too much going on the bespoke order process? And does that contribute to where the brand is today?
I think life is hard and life is complex and running a business is hard. And that's coming for me. And it's when I had my watch made, there were three steel cases. There was the one that William bought, which was the prototype sold publicly at auction, right? There was one on the wrist of the then CEO. And there was a third case and I was visiting them and I said, hey, I love this thing. Like I might need some payment terms, but like, can I have the third case? And they were like, all right. Like, and I called William because he's my friend and said, hey, is it cool if I do the third case? He's like, yeah, whatever. And I designed a dial or helped design a dial in what is absolutely Hodinkee gray, like the same color as everything we do to this day, with Breguet numerals. I left the LF hands because I thought that was really important. The back of the watch is inscribed LF for BC, like they made it for me. And they made it for me. And I was just absolutely smitten with it, completely in love with it, still own it to this day. And then all of a sudden, I saw another one in the market. And then I saw another one in the market. And then I saw another one in the market, including like some of them ended up with friends. Eric Koo had one for a while. My friend Dusik had one for a while. And even when I posted this watch on Instagram the other day, someone was like, "Hey, I just got that watch." And you know, again, like I don't really care. And it wasn't like, you know, we didn't sign a contract saying like, you can't make this again. And like, whatever, it's a gray dial with Breguet numerals. It's not like I invented anything here. But you know, it's that type of stuff that just like erodes some, I don't want to say trust, because it's not about trust, but just like good feeling with a brand. And to be clear, we have done 3 collaborations with LF and all of them successful. I wear the Travel Time often, and I wear a white gold one often as well. 3 different movements in those. So like, I still believe in that brand, and like the management has changed several times since that. That was an unfortunate situation, but not life-changing. And we still work with them. And I think there's also other things, you know, they use distributors in places where they didn't need to use distributors. There's a lot of stuff that they could have done better, I think. But again, like everything's in hindsight. And selling a $50,000 time-only watch, if you're not Patek Philippe, in the year 2020 or 2014 was fucking hard. You know, so like, who am I to say? Like, you can't, like, if somebody likes this watch and they're going to pay you that much money for it, you're really going to say no? Like, of course they're going to say yes, you know? And like, that's why there's so many weird Jorns out there. And that's why, like, you know, the caliber 89s in all the different metals are weird. And like the Graves, right? Like the Graves is a completely custom watch. They did it because they had to, you know, not necessarily because they wanted to. And that's okay. And so I don't have animosity towards Laurent Ferrari in any way. And I would buy another one to this day. But there's no question that like things didn't go the way we thought they would. And that's because I think they overproduced. They had distributors and retailers that were discounting when they didn't need to. Right. And I think the world just kind of evolved around them. You know, when you see Roger and I mean, Jorn, I mean, like, think about Jorn. And granted, there's like some exterior forces there and we all know that. But like Jorn, we're selling for at retail 50 cents on the dollar, like from the store. You know, it's crazy. As crazy as that is, like you could go in and negotiate on a CB or on a Resonance or whatever. And so Jorn and Laurent Ferrari were in the exact same spot 7 years ago, and look where they are now. And you know, again, Jorn has bigger investors and, you know, bigger partners, et cetera, and a greater history, and they really do make everything that they say they do. But yeah, it's a shame. I still think like one day when Hodinkee's said and done, or I'm, you know, whatever, I make that, you know, tons of money that everybody thinks I already have, which I do not. I'm going to go out and I'm going to buy Laurent Ferrier, and I'm going to make it what it could be, because like that, this still has some of the best potential of any brand out there, in my opinion.
Let's play this Monday morning quarterback game for just a second longer. I mean, let's say that day comes, Ben, but what do you do? Maybe it is from a modern product perspective, or maybe it is from a supporting the secondary market perspective, but what would you do differently to sort of support the development and perception of the brand among collectors? And, you know, if you can, maybe, I'm curious, like, this doesn't have to be a Laurent Ferrier specific discussion, but I'm curious, you know, there are presumably other brands in this category as well. And I'm wondering, like, what can be done to sort of support the collector market for brands like that?
It's, I mean, look, the two best examples of it, and they're both still ongoing, is obviously Jorn and Debuthen. What Watchboxer 1916 is now doing with them is like they bought the company, they cleaned up the product, they cleaned up the market, as in like they supported the stuff at auction. And like people knew that, and it doesn't matter, right? I mean, like you're still getting the results. And Jorn, obviously the same thing, and 1916 was involved with that as well. It's about cleaning up the market and projecting confidence and success to clients, because like as I say often, and I certainly said yesterday up at Cornell, it's like nobody really needs a $50,000 watch that tells time. You know, it's like a $2,000 watch, that's crazy. $50,000 is absurd. You know, and that's what we're talking about here. So you really want to elevate the brand from like, hey, will you please buy this thing, to like, you should feel lucky to be allocated one of these things. And that's what Laurent Ferrier has always struggled with. At times, they've done it well. They did collaborations with us that were really hot, collaborations with Way and Revolution that were pretty hot. And, you know, occasionally here and there, they did it with some retailers that were pretty strong, and then their own watches. But they made too many, and their distributors and retailers never respected the brand in the way that they should have, because they worked with people that were from a different era of watch retailing. You know, every watch was at discount for some of these guys for so long, you know, and even Patek. And so I think it's just about like updating the model and your partners with to remain relevant and remain at the forefront of stuff. So, but I mean, cleaning up the market, which is insanely expensive, to be clear, and then doing the product that should be done the right way. And also the challenge, and I love Laurent Ferrier, the man, he's not a watchmaker, right? Like he's not, he could assemble a watch, but he can't design a watch from a caliber perspective. Neither can Max Bucer. Neither can I, for that matter. Like, you know, there's some good people out there that can't do that. That's okay. But I think, you know, when you get down to it, like F.P. Jorn is an insane watchmaker. Denis at Debuthun is also an insane watchmaker. And LF has, his son is a watchmaker, as far as I know. But, you know, it's not the same. Like, you sit down with Kari Voutilainen or Dufour and Roger, and you're like, these guys are like walking encyclopedias. And Laurent Ferrier is not necessarily that. But he has a lot of other talents, just like Max Bucer has a lot of other talents, you know? And so it's just, you know, Max was able to sell a dream and sell himself and sell innovative, thoughtful, cool design. And I think there was this perception that LF really was like a Dufour like watchmaker, and he's not. And that's okay. But I just think it's important to know what you're kind of getting into there.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And I think one of the things that's happened with the way the indie market has developed is we treat these things as, whether or not they are, I think we treat them as art, and we treat the guys that create them as living artists, and we right. treat the watchmaking as the art. And there's a perception, real or not, if you're not a watchmaker, that perhaps there's something missing there. There are all kinds of different ways to get around it. You alluded to MB&F, which is one great way to do it, right? It's so design driven and cool in a totally different way. But man, that stuff is like really avant-garde. So you really have to figure out your lane if you're not a true sort of watchmaker's watchmaker, you know?
Yeah. I mean, now I'm actually thinking about it, like if I had the money and had control of Laurent Ferrier, like I would go out and find a Recep style watchmaker, or, you know, somebody that, you know, and obviously not Recep because he's doing just fine, but somebody that is young and hungry and has ideas, and bring them under the fold. And I think what we're seeing now, and we see this frankly with watch media and everything, is you get a lot of young, hungry guys, and they all want to go it alone. And sometimes that works. We've seen it fail spectacularly as well. But you know, it's challenging to bring somebody in under like an existing confine, especially in the manufacturing side. If you're a talented watchmaker, you want to be Recep Recepi. You want to be Raoul Page. You want to be, you know, you want your name on the dial. And that's the challenge with Laurent Ferrier. As I said, he has a son named Christian, who's a great guy, who, you know, could lead it. But I think, you know, the other thing also is like, it's cash, man. You know, like just finding somebody to, you know, it's not easy to make money selling watches. Although, you know, George Kern and Jean-Claude Beaver and Reynald, like they figured out a way to do it. But like, we're talking the minority here, not the majority.
Are there any other brands, before we kind of close out this discussion, are there other brands or watchmakers that fall into this category that we've been talking about? Of, I mean, the horological chops are there. You talked about the Tourbillon and then the Microrotor and things that they've developed since then that continue to be really, really interesting, right? I mean, the Natural Escapement, that's nothing. That dates back to the days of Breguet. Are there other brands that fall into this category of having the horological fundamentals, but the market for one reason or another does not sort of appreciate them right now?
There's two versions of Lange, the Lange story. There is modern Lange at retail, which I'm told is doing still exceptionally well, like record-setting months year over year. Like, I'm quite sure that year over year for 24, they're anniversarying and exceeding. So like, they're literally having their best months ever at retail. What I refer to with Lange is, I don't understand, and this is like, you know, the old guy screaming on the porch again. There are watches that when I was coming up in the 2013s, 2014s with Paul Boutros and the Weenies, if you even know what that is, that's Watch Enthusiasts of New York. That was like the first like Red Bar group. But I'm talking like, we used to go to like nice restaurants and like had like, you know, Beat Haldeman come in and like tell us about his tourbillons and stuff. It was like incredibly nerdy. Back then, the most celebrated high-end watches from a big brand were early Langes. So Port La Marie Tourbillon was it. The original Phantom Zeitwerk, the Platinum Lumen Zeitwerk was it. I mean, it was as cool as it got. The Hanneroek Squint stuff, like the really, really special early, early stuff. The Close Case Back, they're, you know, less so the early Datagraph, which I know is really hot now, but I mean, it had a lot of love. And what I don't understand, I guess, is with all these watches from the early 90s being so hot with guys like you, with the youngins, how have those fallen by the wayside? And like, you know, I can give an example because in the text group, I was kind of going on a rant the other day. Right now, there are two platinum Port-La-Marie tourbillons for sale on the market. And they've been for sale because I've been in touch with the sellers because it's a watch I've always wanted. They've been for sale for months and they're online. It's not like they're behind the scenes or anything like that. There are also at least two, maybe three platinum Phantom Lumen Sightworks on the market. And I'm not talking honey gold, which the honey gold now trades more than the platinum. I just don't understand why. And closed case back longas, which I've had a bunch of. I have one now. Like, they're just amazing watches and super important. I don't know why these watches aren't hotter or more talked about than they are. And our good friend Tantan, who works at the company with us here, he's like Mr. Longa. He knows more about Longa than anybody I know these days, but he's young. And I think there's just a generational divide between the guys like me. He's probably 15 years younger than me, if not more. And he's just like, I don't know about this watch. Like, I don't know why I should spend 400 grand if I had it on a platinum Port-La-Marie Tourbillon, which is, I think the real issue here is like the pricing of yesterday just hasn't kept up with today. And so I think like the $400,000 plus price point for the platinum Port-La-Marie, which is what they've traded for historically when they come up and they go fast, is now just not reality. There are other Longas out there, maybe for more modern stuff, that might hit those prices, but I think just there's not enough people that care about those watches at those price points.
I think from the market today perspective, it's like, at least in my opinion, and Ben, you can tell me I'm wrong, but pre-owned Longa has always had issues. It's always sort of underperformed. I know these very, very flagship and like the most collectible models have been there in the past. And maybe we're seeing a lot of inventory in those models right now. And it seems like they're not moving anymore, but core collection or non-special, and not to say the watches aren't special, but regular Longa pre-owned has always been an issue. And it was alleviated a little bit, like the Datagraph thing happened. And I'll correct you. Early Datagraphs are not hot right now. They're down probably 30% since a year and a half ago.
Okay, got it.
They peaked, and I thought that was going to start a trend of these regular production Longas, at least the important ones, close case packs, early Longa ones, this kind of stuff, gathering momentum for what I see is the first time. You can tell me I'm wrong, but I don't think any of that stuff have ever traded massively over retail to a point where it is a thing.
Oh, well, I mean, look, these are different things, right? I mean, like, retail for the, like, a Platinum Longa One, I'm sorry, Platinum Port-La-Marie in 1994 was probably 80 grand. So it's certainly above retail for sure, like many times retail, but we're talking 30 years ago, you know? And so I think, like, I'm talking about slightly different things. I think, like, early series Datagraphs, there are a bunch of them. But the Port-La-Marie Tourbillon, which to me is, like, it's the best Tourbillon ever made, as far as I'm concerned, for a wristwatch. I don't know how that has fallen out of favor to the point where two of them can just sit on Chrono 24. I think that's my point. Is like, I agreed, like the secondary market of core collection Longa has always been a challenge. It's gotten a lot better, like a lot better. But this is really more like as a collector of like really, I try to collect really special things. It's just alarming to me because again, if I'm going to break the bank on a watch, like the Port-La-Marie Tourbillon would be right up there. And I'm not in that mindset right now. But I just don't get how these are just sitting there. I really don't. And I think it's also like, I know one of the sellers of one of these watches and he bought the watch new, right? So he bought the watch in 1996. He's in his, I would guess, early 70s, late 60s. Like he doesn't need the money. And he's probably thinking of when he was really into watches 10 years ago, these were the holy grail. And so he's not going to accept anything less than, you know, what he believes to be the price. And that's long the challenge with these, this kind of like generational shift of collecting.
To reference our colleague Tantan again, because this is a great point that he made, which I will not pass off as my own, but the move of modern Longa distribution to their own boutiques possibly has created a lot of disgruntled former buyers at retailers, which means a lot more regular Longas or even special Longas on the market today. And you can see that if you go to any of the sites which you would go to shop Longa, there is a lot of pre-owned inventory out there. And while we're talking about different sections of Longa's pre-owned market, I think having a lot of regular or even somewhat special Longas available for sale and a perceived slow market hurts things like a PLM that you're talking about.
The one thing I'll say is like this year is an anniversary year for Langa, and like people care about that stuff. And it's, you know, it's the greatest story. It's the greatest brand creation story in watchmaking of the past 30 years, as far as I'm concerned. Like, this is a real brand. This is not Philippe Dufour or Jorn, who's making, you know, a few watches a year. Like, this is a real brand. And they've made like, you know, over 75 calibers in the last 30 years. I mean, it's just crazy numbers. I think there's a chance that Watches and Wonders, the big trade show coming up in a month, actually, wow, it's actually just a month away, I think could change things. And I don't know what they're showing, and I mean that sincerely, but I'm told it's pretty good. And I think, like, you know, Lange has a way of exciting real watch nerds in a way that almost no other brand does. So I'm optimistic. I really am. But, you know, to those two sellers of Platinum Pour Le Marie Tourbillons out there, like, give me a call if you want to cut your price in half. You know, like, I think these watches are amazing and I really want one, but I just, like, I'm scared that, like, I'm seemingly the only guy who thinks these are like the right prices for these watches.
You and the weenies.
Me and the weenies. Yeah, look it up. I don't know if there's any record of the weenies ever existing, but it was a great group. Shout out to Paul Boutros and the weenies.
Perhaps we'll leave the discussion there for today, but I think it was somewhat enlightening, somewhat interesting. Talking about a different segment of the market. Yeah. We haven't discussed for at least on this iteration of the Hodinkee podcast. So thanks to Rich Ford, and thanks to Ben Clymer. Thanks to our editor, Vic Ottomanelli. And thank you all for listening. We'll be back with another episode of Hodinkee Radio next week.